And we are back. Welcome to part two of the retrospective. We're actually doing retrospectives.
Look at us.
This is amazing.
Five big name movies in this category with big name people
and
involved.
And none of them are the Cloverfield Paradox.
Correct.
Amazingly. We're doing the second part now today of the 1989-1990 Best Original Screenplay Oscar category. We already reviewed in part one the winner, which was Dead Poets Society, along with one of the most timeless movies that we've come across thus far, and Do the Right Thing from Spike Lee. Today we'll be going over Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Crimes and Misdemeanors, and what's the one I'm forgetting here?
Oh, right off the top, When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, that's why I forgot it.
It's a mental block.
Block that fucking thing out of my mind.
Traumatic, PTSD.
Let me say it now because I might be too angry to say it later. Mike and Oscar on Facebook. Mike and Oscar on Instagram. MM and Oscar on Twitter. Mike and Oscar.com. Mike and Oscar at gmail.com. Find us everywhere. Type in Mike and Oscar. Let's get right into this godforsaken fucking movie.
So here's the thing.
I'm not done introducing it yet. This pile of snow. When Harry Met Sally, Mike's going to give us a production profile. Take it away also, Mike.
All right. So before I get into this, because Mike's going to have a lot of fire for this movie, obviously. The first time we recorded this last summer.
Yes.
I felt like a kid in a grammar school principal's office trying to argue why his prank was so funny.
Okay, good analogy.
And analogy. Mike's like, oh, so you think this is funny? Oh, really? You know, pantsing little Jimmy there.
Why don't we call your parents and see how funny they think it is?
Let's see how funny it is when you're in detention for the rest of the year. So I think what I hope in an olive branch right now, passing, literally reaching across the table with my fake olive branch to Mike, we could be a little more civil. The eyes that he's giving me.
I want this movie dead.
Who hurt you?
Give us the production.
All
notes.
Right. Here's Nora Ephron, her biofilmography, because she's a wonderful human being, Mike. No, he doesn't like
I'm sure
Nora
she's
Ephron.
Fantastic.
She's responsible for this entire genre. And born in 1941, New York City, Nora was the eldest of four sisters with two playwrights for parents, playwrights and screenwriters. They were a writing team and were nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay for Captain M.D. in 1963.
Did we do a song from them or no?
No.
I don't think so either.
Almost. So, yeah. We did Captain Courageous?
No. That sounds like a dog.
We didn't do 1963. Nah, that's all I know. Yeah. Captain something. Captain... It was in 1950.
Captain Antonin. Love lift us up. That's an officer and gentleman. Never mind.
Anyway, we got to do that best original song category coming up.
No, we just have to sing it as a duet, you and I.
Okay. Look, Olive Branch reached across the table already.
I'm going to punch you.
These screenwriting parents of Nora Ephron also wrote Desk Set, starring Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, and Carousel, amongst their other highlights. Nora Ephron's sister, Hallie, is a journalist-turned crime novelist who's written five books. So these progeny.
They're writers, yeah.
Yeah, they're not writers.
They found
for sure.
Their calling.
Yeah. After graduating Wellesley College, right next to Welton, Nora interned at the JFK White House. During that internship, she applied to be a political writer at Newsweek, but they were not hiring women writers at the time. So she took a job in the mailroom of Newsweek, which became the Amazon original series, The Good Girls Revolt.
She's been made for the screen ever since she was born, it sounds like.
The Ephron estate sued Amazon for an unlicensed portrayal of her in that TV show. And of course, when the TV show kind of sucked, Amazon canceled it after one season. Ephron fought to get her writing into the Newsweek magazine and succeeded a few times. One of which was a satire about the New York Post, which you get in amazing fashion, actually hired Ephron not shortly after.
We like the way you shit on us.
Yeah.
Come in.
Which is kind of cool. She also got freelance jobs for Esquire and Cosmopolitan, those magazines. In 1970, she's moving her way into movies and narrative stuff. She was hired to write a draft of All the President's Men. This was not one of the drafts that was used in production. William Goldman got credit for that one in its 1974 release. But apparently Ephron, in her research, was one of the people who got to know the true identity of Deep Throat.
Wow.
Who she freely told interviewers for years after this that it was Mark Felt for all those years. And nobody
could you not? I'm trying to keep it secret.
Nobody believed her. But, I mean, she marries Carl Bernstein. Mm-hmm. She has two kids.
Of Woodward and Bernstein,
with
yes.
Carl Bernstein, yep, of the actual people who broke the Watergate story. Their children, of course, were given the vocational choices of becoming writers or journalists years later, which they, I believe they all have come. They attended the Welton School for boys.
The opposite of, yeah, of the Dead Poets Society right. through line.
No, I don't know anything about their kids. Anyway, the All the President's Men job netted Efron more than just a husband. It grabbed her accredited screenwriting job for the TV movie Perfect Gentlemen, which was kind of enough to launch her screenwriting career, basically. Mike Nichols hires her to write Silkwood.
Big name.
That gets her an Oscar nomination, so she's off and running after
that. Yeah, Silkwood was famously one of the Meryl Streep properties.
Meryl Streep, Cher, Sleepless in Seattle, When Harry Met Sally happens later in the 80s. She does another Mike Nichols movie in the very late 80s called Heartburn. And her final highlight from that decade was My Blue Heaven in the 90s.
Oh, wow.
Nora Ephron had the smash hit You've Got Mail in 1998.
Keeps dipping back into that Meg Ryan well.
Capitalized on the AOL chat room craze, which the kids can understand as Snapchat without the photos, perhaps.
To Catch a Predator, if you've ever seen that. That was based on all AOL chat rooms.
You have a lot of positive feedback in this one. Even on the innocent kind, it's not positive. Oh, no, I'm so afraid.
Are you in it to win it 69? Take a seat.
Nora Ephron writes Bewitched, Julia and Julia in the 21st Century, amongst many other films.
She's kind of going between muses here. Meg Ryan, Meryl Streep. She's done a lot of big movies for both those women.
She received a posthumous Tony for her play, Lucky Guy, because she does get leukemia, unfortunately, and dies in 2012. She also wrote 8 books throughout this past 15 years, but they are not movies, so we're not going to mention those again.
Who reads?
Ew, books. So, and that's Nora Ephron. She's had a very successful career. This movie, in many ways, draws upon the slapstick rom-coms of the 50s and 40s that her parents wrote.
Oh, is that what this movie
does? For Katherine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy there.
You sure that's what this movie does?
That movie builds on a lot of that stuff, so you can't entirely give her the stalker fetish credit, but... So this is going to be interesting. So I'm going to let you rage, and I'm going to agree with you more than I did last time. However,
because you've come to your senses.
I've come to my senses because you made some good points. However, this movie does have its charms, Michael.
I'm not going to say it doesn't. I can give it the credit for being the innovative and the kind of the trailblazer that it is.
I jabbed that olive branch into your eye, and it somehow softened you just a little
bit. But let me tell you what this movie's really about. This is the movie that glorifies stalking.
Does the end justify the means, though?
No! No!
So you have the plot premise.
Not when the means is a felony. When Harry Met Sally, we'll do some specs first. Debuted July 21st, 1989, directed by Rob Reiner, written, as Mike said, by Nora Ephron. It was the movie's only Oscar nomination. 96 minutes of unabashed torture unleashed on this world by Castle Rock and Nelson Entertainment, who produced it, and Columbia Pictures, who distributed it.
Come on, Louis.
$16 million budget. I'm in the middle of speaking here, sir. That inexplicably fooled enough people to bring in $92.8 million in box office during its theatrical run. I can only assume that Carrie Fisher used the force in that regards for this one, too.
Oh, no.
7.6 IMDb rating on 167,000 plus reviews, meaning there are roughly about 100,000 people or more that I never want to speak to. An 89% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating on 66 critic scores, 59 of them being positive, the average score of 8 out of 10, and a lie of a 90% audience score, which I flat out don't believe and won't have my intelligence insulted as such for hearing it, on 395 plus thousand reviews, averaging a 3.5 out of 5. Even its meta rating doesn't help me, as it stands at a 76 meta score, and I've never felt more alone on this planet. This is When Harry Met Sally.
You sure it wasn't When Harry and Tonto, another movie?
We need
from
to stop with the Harry Ann's. Harry and the Henderson should be the only Harry Ann movie that is made.
Do you hate that one too?
It's got its moments.
You're the first person who I've met that genuinely hates this movie.
It's so bad.
So I'm trying to get inside your psyche. I want to put
a
camera on you.
That's a dangerous place to be.
And get to the bottom
of
why you...
that old Jennifer Lawrence movie, The Cell, where she goes into the mind of a serial killer and it's just all fucked up?
Is that what it is?
Up.
That's where I'm going to go.
This is a Meg
Have
Ryan...
Have you tried some of these moves on women and it didn't work for you and it just rebounded in horrible fashion?
I can't even get that. Women don't look at me.
No.
That's why we do this. So somebody will look
it's
at
like
me.
The blind leading the blind.
This is a Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal.
Blind people analyzing a painting in this movie.
And we've lost
Us
our blind audience. Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan are in this movie because I guess Tom Hanks was busy. We start at the University of Chicago, Harry Burns with the Billy Crystal character.
No, we start with cityscapes, montages of them,
and Louis Armstrong music, it had to be you, doobity-doo. If you said bippity-boppity-boo, you might have liked this.
This is what I have to deal with. It's just slow breathing like the Zodiac on the other side of the phone here. It's not funny. Damn it.
Harry Burns, Billy Crystal character. I almost blacked out there. Kissing his girlfriend, I guess. Sally Albright, his girlfriend's friend, played by Meg Ryan, offers to drive him basically cross-country to New York. So they're going from Chicago to New York on this road trip. A lot of quirky things happen along the way. They're just so goddamn charming. They argue about how men and women can never be platonic friends because there's always sexual tension, which is Billy Crystal's stance.
Yeah, the mistake I made last time was trying to argue with you on why all of this was funny. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to say I found some of it funny.
You're wrong.
All right. Well, you didn't. That's fine. I just want to know who's hurt you.
They immediately start talking about life, though. They hit it off, like, in a way, I understand it's a movie, and I understand that's the point of this. But they hit it off in a way that two humans just don't hit it off. Like, not to this extent. They end up themselves at a diner. She's giving very quirky food orders because she's just so charming. And look at her. She's cute and adorable. And oh, my God.
Well, Mike, he has to groom her. I mean, that's the wrong word. He has to condition her. That's wrong again. All right, you may have a point.
Thank you.
they have to start talking about sex before they can eventually have it.
All he needed was the fucking bell. I'm Pavlov.
This is the paradoxical argument at the center of this movie. Can men and women become friends when the sex part always gets in the way?
Yes, that is the through line. That is the stance.
And it actually works in terms of the climax at the end.
That is the stance that Billy Crystal takes, and that's kind of the through line, correct storyline that we deal with throughout the movie. They end up getting to New York after having a tension-filled argument, and they just kind of part on their ways, even though they did have obvious chemistry between the two of them. All of these scenes in time are spaced out across a timeline, and every time we jump to a new scene, we're met with an old couple on a couch talking about how they met or how they fell in love or what happened, et cetera, et cetera. So
okay,
we go
Mike,
to one of those old couples.
Are you ready for my smoking gun? Because I can't go any further with this without at least giving you my smoking gun.
Sure.
Since this movie is written by a woman, Nora Ephron,
uh-huh,
who has dealt with very pushy male personas. Carl Bernstein is a pushy male persona.
Yes.
Do you think she is portraying Billy Crystal in a negative light on purpose? Because as a man who's very stalkery. And she is portraying that in a not the way Dead Poets Society portrayed everyone.
But she is.
She's not portraying him in a positive way is my point.
No, but I disagree. I think she is. Because all his stalking is supposed to be play as charming.
But it doesn't work out for him. It does.
But he also doesn't take no for an answer, which is a big problem today with a lot of men.
Okay. I tried. But I'm just saying she's portraying it negatively, I would think.
That's an interesting... If that's true... Then it's above my head, and props to her, but it's also above everybody's head.
But you're agreeing with her.
I am, but I don't think it's given the proper tone, if that's the case. Like, he should be the antagonist, the bad guy, a stalker.
Here's the thing, like...
A sexual deviant.
Collared shirts, polo shirt wearing men, dancing to jazzercise videos... with a jazzercise class, these kind of scenes are interwoven into this plot, which is funny to me. And I'm laughing at them as much as I am with them.
Sure.
But this movie has a lot of those moments. So 90s, so oh, hello.
You know what other moments it has?
Yeah.
Stalker moments.
There's a couple
straight up illegal moments that are
driven. What's illegal, though? He's on a plane and he kind of peeks over the seat. Again, it's a...
But he changes seats first!
He changes seats, but that's not illegal.
We're getting it. It's not illegal.
He's at the store and he kind of...
No, it's not illegal. But again, this is the problem with men today.
Yeah.
Like,
you're not saying it's illegal. You're wrong.
You know how many women have gone to the cops and been like, this guy's following me? And they're like, well, he hasn't done anything illegal, so he can't do anything!
She stalks him a little bit, too, in the movie, which is true. It's true.
We're 5 years later.
Okay.
Harry walks past Sally, who's kissing his friend Joe, played by Stephen Ford, at the airport. And we get the idea that they're, like, inevitably supposed to be seeing each other. Joe and Sally part with an I love you, and Sally is on the plane alone. And then Harry moves his seat on the plane from where he was to get behind Sally's
seat. Not illegal, counselor.
Oh, God. You know what? And sneaks up behind her seat and says, hey, remember me? Yeah. I just happened to see you from afar. Remember we hung out 5 years ago?
It's creepy.
Been thinking about you.
I think the word is creepy. You're right.
You know how your underwear is blue today?
Creepy men should not succeed as much as Billy Crystal does in this movie.
So the airplane conversation happens with them sitting next to each other now. Harry estimates Joe and Sally are early in their relationship. You never take someone to the airport unless you're early in your relationship. Also reveals that he himself, Harry, is getting married to a woman named Helen.
Right.
They land, and Harry asks Sally to dinner, just as friends, as
which
a play
on. Which
is
scummy, by the way.
You think?
Because he's getting married, and he's still hitting on her
crazy
for an entire plane ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. But he's meeting Sally, and when Harry meets Sally in this movie, they have to talk about the same through line.
So Billy is basically Harry, I guess, is walking back his previous statement of how men and women can't be platonic friends. And he's trying to ask Sally to dinner for that reason, prove he's platonic friends. Except that we all know he doesn't want to just ask her to dinner to be platonic friends. Because like you just said, it's scummy. You can tell that he's still hitting with her on her and infatuated with her. Fine. Old couple on the couch. We go to another 5 years later. Sally has broken up with Joe and he's talking to her two friends, one of which is played by Carrie Fisher, who's Marie in this story, wants to set her up with one of Marie's own friends.
Right.
And Harry is talking about his going through a divorce with Helen with his friend Jess, which is my favorite scene here at the Cubs game. They're talking about how life is so serious and tragic and this big breakup in the midst of doing the wave that's going around the stadium, so they have to keep
standing up.
Giants game. Oh, I'm sorry. The Giants game. I thought it was Cubs game.
NYG.
That they had to keep standing up and doing the wave and talking about how serious life is and et cetera, et cetera. That was funny.
You liked that the one football scene in the movie.
That's right.
All right. I did too. I love that scene too.
We go from there to the bookshop where Marie reveals the man she's having an affair with just bought his wife some lingerie and she's afraid he'll never leave her. The Marie character is well done in this. I don't think Carrie Fisher.
Yeah. I really like that character. I genuinely liked her character too. And I always forget his name in The Godfather, the big fat guy, Credenza. It's not Credenza.
Bruno Kirby, the Jess
Bruno
character.
Bruno Kirby, yeah. Who played Credenza in The Godfather.
Yeah, no, Chandelier.
People hate me. Anyway, the younger version of that is Bruno Kirby. And I just he's so stereotypically New York.
He is.
And he fits so well with Carrie Fisher's character. I really enjoyed them as foils, I just want to say.
Hey, Mike, guess who runs into Sally just so happens to be at the same bookstore?
You're right, and he does like kind of peer over.
Yes, he does
in a very stalkery way. Yes,
all he needed was a fucking hat, a fedora, one of those flat brimmed things, and he needed to say how he's been so nice to her that she owes him sex, and he would have fit the stereotype to a T.
But he doesn't do that, Mike, does he? He becomes he builds a genuine friendship with her instead.
Why?
Written by Nora Ephron.
Why does he?
And they both.
Why?
Because they both have sexual attraction.
Sex.
Well, they both.
She does not have sexual attraction to him at first.
Here's the thing. Once that happens, the romance blossoms from there. It does.
Because the romance is based on bullshit. When's the last time you had an hours long at night conversation about a girl, about Casablanca?
The romance is built on friendship.
Tell me the last time you talked to someone about Casablanca.
Friends.
They're only friends because he keeps inserting himself into her life after her rejections.
You're not wrong, but it is creepy, but it's not illegal.
I'm going
Again,
to start stalking
I want to say.
You. like he does to Sally in this movie.
It's written by
and
her.
You're going to see.
It's written by Nora Ephron,
you're gonna
Michael.
See,
it's not written by Billy Crystal.
You're going to see how not illegal it is when I'm staring through your window while you're eating dinner.
They're not. He's not staring through her window. He's at the
store.
He's staring
at her at the plane.
Bumping
he's staring
into
at
her
on the airport.
In
he's staring
public
at
places.
Her in the, oh, that makes it okay.
No, but he's not going and stalking her at her apartment. He's public.
Do you realize how
places.
Stupid you sound right now? Oh, he's only staring at her in public. It's fine.
He's bumping into her
cat
by
calling
accident.
Isn't a big deal.
He's bumping into her by accident.
No, he is not. He was forcing himself to bump into her.
No.
He's moving his seat on the plane to bump
well,
into
yeah,
her. He's stalking her out at the bookstore to bump into her.
But them being in the same place at the same time is not something that he is orchestrating.
You know what I would
like
do?
Like a true stalker.
If I got treated the first time by like Sally did to Harry and I saw someone else that treated me like that, I would avoid the situation.
I'm trying to
I wouldn't interject myself back into
I'm
it.
I'm trying to play devil's
because
advocate.
Because I knew
that 90%
somebody there
of people
wouldn't want me
there.
We're
talking over each other like one of the testimonials in the story right now, like an old married couple ourselves.
So they start falling for each other stupidly.
We're proving the plot of the story by the fact that we're going to come together at the end of this review.
Can't wait till we talk
because
about,
we're lovers and friends,
talk
you
about
see.
Casablanca.
They're both, Mike. For the record, I don't love Casablanca as much as some other people. It has some good writing
we
dilemmas.
We probably are going to do that as a review one day.
Yeah,
for
we'll
a
have to do that. It doesn't hold up as well as people think.
Where the fuck are we?
I don't know. I guess what's getting best, worst, we'll see scenes. Best.
No, because we got to talk about that stupid fucking dining room table or coffee table.
Okay, this was... Oh.
Jess and Marie end up getting married. They go on a double date with Harry and Sally. Harry and Sally are trying to introduce them to each other. Jess to Sally, Harry to Marie. Jess and Marie hit it off. They end up getting married.
Right.
Harry's going through an existential crisis, basically, because he ran into Helen. So they talk about this fucking coffee table that's
wagon
at Jess
wheel
and Marie's table. House. Go ahead. Take it.
Well, essentially, the wagon wheel coffee table is a metaphor for the nonsensical arguments that they always have, and they're both right at the end of the day, where they're both partially right, very a la Spike Lee, and of course, the wagon wheel coffee table has to go, because Bruno Kirby is just, you know, he's being a jerk about it, because, of course, it's a gross wagon wheel coffee table, and the fact that after Harry and Sally get in the argument they're getting into, on the outside, Billy Crystal slams the wagon wheel coffee table in a reverse after supporting it, so it's a scene that works very well in terms of the writing of it, and it's kind of funny if you have a sense of humor about this movie, unlike my co-host here.
Every second.
Most people like this movie. Can I get mad? I'm going to get mad for once. Most people like this movie. Most people are with me. So I have a job to do them a little justice here and getting mad at you for a second. How about that? 90%.
Every second I breathe during this movie is a second I take
I've
away
never met a person who hates this movie.
From doing something
it's adorable. There's old, there's real old people kind of talking about how they fell in love.
And they're
in
all
this
dead.
Movie.
Like the real Sally would be dead if the real Harry did these fucking things to her and was rejected this many times.
You're overstating this. I think this movie is touching such nerves for you because the conventions that this movie at least built upon,
the
if not started.
The conventions are the only thing I have positive.
The conventions are what led to rom-coms that you have rightly so slandered, like Letters to Juliet, When in Rome.
I fucking hate those movies.
That remind you of bad breakups of your life's past, and you're fucking Ebenezer Scrooge right now looking through the ghost of whatever Christmas past, and this is why you're upset.
This movie... This Fuck. Movie, I don't understand you as a rational human being and film critic, how you can have such a visceral disdain for Knox's actions
because
in Dead Poets Society.
I don't
Society.
Equate the two of them.
How? Mike, they're the same.
They're not the same.
What did Knox do before he kissed that girl?
He didn't bump into her at the electronics store.
He was stalking her out from afar at the party.
But he went to the party to stalk her. Billy Crystal was on the same plane by chance, by happenstance.
So he had to stalk her. He had to.
No, he had to introduce himself.
He just didn't have a choice.
You're just getting caught up on the creepy looks he gives, but that's a Billy Crystal problem. That's not the
I cannot believe
Nora Ephron wrote this movie.
I don't give a shit. You keep saying that like it matters. Fuck.
If an old white man wrote this movie, your argument would be basically proven just by, I don't have the words as a lawyer here to understand what I'm supposed to say. What's the word? Your argument would have been proven by...
Res ipso loquitur, the thing speaks for itself?
Yes. Thank you. My brain couldn't find it.
Here's what we can agree on. Michael Bublé is a time traveler. Because at the end of this movie, there's a song that plays that sounds exactly like Michael Bublé, who was not famous in 1989.
Michael Bublé has covered it, and he sounds exactly like other people.
Why do you have to... You're arguing with me about this?
Once I start, I can't stop. I'm sorry. Yeah, no, great. Michael Bublé, great.
What's your best scene?
The wagon wheel coffee table.
You're an idiot. You're a fucking idiot. The best scene is the wave at the game where they're talking about true life.
But here's the thing about this movie. They give the men logical arguments. They give the women logical arguments. Don't give me that stuff with the Rorschach test about the feminism where the women can't talk about have a scene where they're not talking about men. This movie is about the interaction between women and men. So
you'd rather stalk a woman against her will or hang out on a cross-country road trip with a cat?
I can't answer
the question, Michael.
I can't win. So
what's your least favorite scene?
There really isn't one.
Oh god damn you. This movie is the least favorite scene. All right, go ahead.
That's all I got.
You don't have a least. You don't. There's one thing. This is the perfect movie.
No, but I don't have a scene that's terribly written. I thought it was.
I think I've been well established as to what the least favorite scene of mine is.
Yeah, I guess a few moments can be a little, you know, taken
felonious.
Taken.
They can be slightly
out of context.
They do have sex. They end up together at a New Year's Eve party. That's the big...
All right, so you don't like this romantic comedy, and yet you're going to have positive reviews on our next movie, which is about a guy who's the creepy camera operator for pornography.
Because he's presented as a creepy camera operator for pornography.
Okay.
I mean, if Harry was presented as a stalker...
Well, Harry's like Keanu presented Reeves and, like a jerk, and it doesn't work out for him, his wiles... The things that he does doesn't work out for him. It's not a morality play where Harry's modus operandi saved the day for him. They have to become friends. Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal become friends and lovers, and both can work, which is a paradoxical answer for that argument.
You're going to see me everywhere you go from now on.
And you're gonna I'm see, right about that
you're
much.
You're going to see how non-illegal it is. Sex Lies and Videotape. Give us a production profile.
All right. Steven Soderbergh biofilmography here. Born in 1963 in Atlanta, Georgia. He grew up in Baton Rouge, where both parents taught.
Asian country.
Both parents taught at LSU. He discovered filmmaking as a teenager and borrowed Super 8 cameras from college grad students to make films. After high school, Soderbergh skipped admission to LSU and went straight to Hollywood. He held game show cue cards. He was a freelance editor.
Started from the bottom. Look at him.
He eventually got his big break as the director of music videos in the 1980s, the late 80s, that is. So in this music video, Heyday,
yeah.
9021 Live for Yes turned out to be his breakout hit.
What a ridiculous remember that name band, for a Yes? Song. Oh, I remember Yes vividly, yeah.
Soderbergh went back to Baton Rouge, and I'm going to insert something that I've read recently from Down and Dirty Pictures. They do a huge segment on Sex, Lies, and Videotape and the origin story of Steven Soderbergh. He, during his music video director phase, he had become someone who basically was an alcoholic who went out to the bars every single day. Soderbergh talked about how at one point he had women, three of them, surrounding him at this bar that he had had sex with, that he had supposedly at the time were his girlfriends all at once, and basically turned into a huge fight or something between all three girls who realized they were all...
Yeah, that's probably how that'll end.
So he basically admits, Soderbergh, in interviews later on, especially for that book by Peter Biskin, that he was a scumbag for those early years of his life, and he literally wanted to move himself back like the James Spader character in this story, take himself out of the game, out of the romantic life, and just be monastic in a way, or have the vow of celibacy like the Spader character.
So this is biographical.
So
in a way.
This is autobiographical. How about that? Which is why he was able to write it, the bastard, in 8 days. That's the alleged claim. So this movie being written so fast and getting some independent financing winds up being bought by Miramax, coming out of the Palm d'Or win at the Cannes Film Festival. Miramax and Harvey Weinstein, they were desperate for a hit. They were doing a lot of schlocky movies that were making some money, which will a formula they would later perfect with Dimension Films and the Scream franchise, which as much as Tarantino kind of built Miramax into the Weinstein company, into the mid-major, mini-mid-major, I guess you'd call it, that it became. Soderbergh essentially becomes a huge success, $25 million at the domestic box office with a movie that had a less than $1 million budget. But he does not sell out afterwards. He takes his time after this breakout success and only does more independent films. He makes the first of what it will be several misspelled TV shows. Grey's Anatomy, G-R-A-Y. He'll make another one, King of the Hill, later. So he makes the names of these TV shows as independent films before the TV shows actually come out, which was a biopic of Franz Kafka, supposed to be a big hit, fell on its face. Yeah. Then he makes another very self-introspective movie called Schizopolis, which he writes, directs, and stars in. Did not go well. He actually, another aside, Weinstein tried to buy it sight unseen. He's like, listen, I'll just buy it. And because they had the relationship beforehand, Soderbergh actually said, Harvey, watch the movie first. I'm not going to accept your buy. I don't think this is for you. Weird fashion. So Soderbergh is a moral man.
Unique cat, yeah.
And Weinstein wound up talking to him later. And you think Weinstein could go one up and be the better man and say, no, I'll buy it anyway, just like I said I would at the beginning. And basically, no. Harvey said, no, thanks for warning.
I can't purchase this.
Thanks for warning me against this. It wasn't until 1998 that Soderbergh kind of finally took the next step as a director.
There's a joke about having good judgment with Harvey Weinstein in there that I just skipped over, but wanted to note that it was on my head.
Oh, my God. Very scary. Let's talk about scary jokes coming off of When Harry Met Sally's review. 1998, Steven Soderbergh directs Out of Sight, a movie that starred George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez, became a huge Hollywood commercial hit. Out of Sight goes into The Limey, which became an independent hit, which leads him to Aaron Brockovich, another box office hit starring Julia Roberts.
Traffic follows that up,
wins him a Best Director Oscar, as well as a Best Picture nomination. And, of course, Ocean's 11, that three-film trilogy, I guess all trilogies are three films, that became
your relationship with numbers in this podcast has really been a fascinating follow.
Good. So he makes Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13. It kind of keeps him going as a relevant filmmaker, and that kind of allows him to make his passion projects: Contagion, Side Effects, Magic Mike. Magic Mike was a small movie at the time, became a huge international hit. So now he's been making indie films all along, which is something very
critically acclaimed ones too. People love Magic Mike. People love Contagion.
So he's had success as a commercial filmmaker.
Side Effects too. Didn't understand it.
Unsane was pretty darn good from this last year. Behind the Candelabra was very critically acclaimed and got some Emmys, I believe. Emmy nominations at least. The Nick was his career on television. In and out of that, he doesn't stay with television though.
Clive Owen needs to be in more things.
Yeah, very true. That show gets under your skin for sure. So he's back into filmmaking, like I said, last August, Logan Lucky, this March, Unsane. Soderbergh won his Oscar for Traffic, like I said. He was also nominated for Aaron Brockovich, and of course for writing Sex, Lies, and Videotape. The movie King of the Hill is his 100%er on the tomato meter. That is Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah. So I didn't know this movie was basically autobiographical. That's interesting. Sex, Lies, and Videotapes from Specs, released August 18th of 1989, directed and written by Soderbergh, as also Mike just told you. The only Oscar that this film was nominated for was Best Original Screenplay. It's a 100-minute runtime produced by Outlaw Productions and distributed by Miramax, the Weinstein leg there. It was made for a paltry $1.2 million, according to Wikipedia, at least, and made $36.7 million total during its worldwide run.
That's more than 2.5 times.
Yeah, just a bit. 7.2 IMDb rating on 42,000 plus reviews, 96% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating on 46 critic ratings, 44 of them being positive with an average rating of 7.9 out of 10. So interestingly enough, we're talking about both the highest rated movie of the nominees amongst critics and the lowest rated IMDb score, which is the common folk everyday moviegoer rating. So that's kind of interesting to me. Carries a 79% audience score on 32,000 votes on Rotten Tomato, average of 3.4 out of 5 with an 86 meta rating. And like Mike told you, this is James Spader kind of being this repressed sexual guy that has this library of videotapes where he's interviewing women about their deepest desires and fantasies.
These videos escalate to the point of pornography.
They start basic as just like a conversation, but they get to these women's deepest, darkest fantasies, desires, wants, cravings. And
we don't see any of it.
No,
for that
we see the interview.
Right, we don't see any porn in this movie.
We assume some of them break down into physicality, as certainly the one that he ends up doing with main character Andy McDowell.
Yeah, James Spader's full of shit.
Yeah. Right.
He's portrayed as such, though.
Yeah, he's a creep. He's a creep. I mean, or repressed. I don't know what you want to define him as in this movie, but it's a very awkward premise when you hear it on its face. He kind of interjects himself into the relationship of the Peter Gallagher's John character, who's married to Andy McDowell's Anne. Anne is a very reserved sexually
cookie cutter creature. Right. I mean, yeah, she's a wife. She's an employee. She's not an employee. She's just a homemaker.
Yeah, at this point. I think so.
Okay. In a way, she's repressed, but
it's not like she's not successful. I mean, she's a successful person. She's just sexually, she's very standoffish.
And it makes sense because Peter Gallagher is having an eyebrow romance with someone who looks like his sister with big eyebrows like him, if I can mention that again. Laura San Giacomo, Cynthia Patrice Bishop, who is just so happens to be Andy McDowell's sister in the movie.
Right.
So again, scummy.
Graham.
Eyebrows.
Graham is James Spader's character. He's John's college friend, and he comes basically to stay a couple days, and we are introduced to him as a character who's very, very unique, because he like says he only wants one key. He doesn't have a key ring. He wants one key to his car, and that's
it. Is there a slimier dinner table conversation that we've seen in the history of our podcast?
Yeah.
That was just the grossest scene, and it's my worst scene of the movie because it's so
I loved it though. It is gross. Ugh. But it's
I guess on rewatch it works because it kind
of
lets you know.
Spader is so perfect for those types of roles. He's just so matter of fact.
The tone of this story being overtly creepy from the start works for you, whereas the other one, which is insidiously mainstream.
Yeah, just, you know, call these characters what they are. And Spader is a sexual, I don't know, deviant predator? I don't know what the right term
Steven
is.
So if Steven Soderbergh directed When Harry Met Sally, it could have worked for you.
Would have been a better film, I'll tell you that. So basically, that's where we are. We have this interesting love triangle. Cynthia, though still being single, even though she's having this affair with John, wants kind of Graham's attention and wants to have Graham notice her.
Yes.
Anne is battling against that. Cynthia eventually does get videotaped by Graham, which leads to Anne finding out that her husband is cheating on her and herself eventually being videotaped by Graham. And she and Graham end up having sex, which John finds out about, sees the tape, and punches out Graham. That's pretty much the plot.
It's a love triangle that goes wrong and essentially brings in, it's a love square.
Kinda. But I mean, Peter Gallagher's not trying to fuck James Spader.
But right. Well, when the love triangle goes wrong, that's when the crisis happens. So the crisis in six scenes works there. I'll be honest with you. The interviews are electric.
Captivating.
They don't get sexual in terms of
You don't see any physicality.
Right.
There's no skin. There's no anything. It's just literally these actresses on screen playing these characters, talking about these characters' sexual desires.
He writes dialogue, the way he writes it is very good. I mean, it's these are arguments in a way.
And they're not grotesquely sexual. No, they're just people talk. It's really weird.
Engaging.
Tough to pull off. Yeah. It's just basic dialogue, like you said. It's nothing that would, you know, you would blush in front of your mother.
Yeah, I was expecting to hate this movie going in, and I, especially after that first scene, as creepy and as distasteful as it was, and then this movie sucks you in.
Yeah, you could definitely see why critics adore it.
Right.
Because it is a little bit higher brow, and it is dialogue driven, and it's based on the intricacies of these characters.
Yeah, he's making some interesting distinctions.
Yeah, you could also see why a general audience may not love it, because it's a slower paced movie. It lags a little in parts. I think the reviews kind of hit it on the head.
Surprisingly cinematic, even though I would say Steven Soderbergh is a talent, and this movie proves why.
Yeah. Let's just dive right into best scene.
All the interviews. I stopped taking notes when I rewatched this movie because I just got caught up in the dialogue. And it's very well written. I think if I wanted to do the screenwriting coach thing and break it down, I could and really come out with a lot of winning formulas, I would say, because he knows how to write.
It really is fascinating when you compare this to some other things we've talked about where the dialogue kind of gets on the nose or gets... This dialogue is almost kind of like leaves you wanting more from these characters, which is
thing. It's a sexual text, right? Because they are talking about sex during the movie, but it's more about just connecting with somebody.
With another human being, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They're trying to connect with one
another. It's funny. The Harry and Sally is like the rom-com version of chemistry, and this is like way more intimate, primal chemistry between two people and why they hit it off in certain ways. There's definitely two sides of the same coin there. The interviews for me, Peter Gallagher's eyebrows, very high note for me in the scene.
Oh, really? So you approved of the brow.
The brow-on-brow love?
The brow-on-brow love. Those are big eyebrows. Those are big early 90s eyebrows. late 80s that became early 90s. That became, I mean, here's the thing. This was a trendsetter in eyebrows.
Yes.
Eyebrow styling.
Eyebrows trailblazing.
Because 90s had some big eyebrows.
My least favorite was the first... The very beginning of the introduction of Anne's character. I thought the therapy scenes were totally unnecessary at the beginning because Soderbergh does enough throughout the movie to distinguish that this is a sexually repressed individual. She's very unhappy in her marriage,
etc. You got to state the theme early on in a movie, and she does that with her therapist. But the first act is my biggest problem with the movie too. So yeah, I can agree with you, but I wouldn't say unnecessary. I would just say ill executed.
Sure. Okay. I'll concede there. Okay. Also, her finding out that her husband and her sister are having an affair by finding an earring of her sister's. Isn't her sister a welcome guest in their home? That's the only way an earring of hers would be there?
I think she thinks he's having an affair because they're not having sex.
She does. I mean, she accuses him of it.
Right.
She accuses him of it.
So then finding another earring in the bed
confirms her speculation. Yeah, sure. Why not?
And then she kind of
just thought that was kind of like,
All right.
Whatever. It's a nitpick. I would say if you're of the dialogue driven and character driven stories, definitely check this one out. Otherwise, I could see how someone could find it lacking.
Right. But you like big eyebrows, big bushy eyebrows,
yes,
movie's course. There. Annie McDowell is fast. I mean, she becomes a star.
She's so good
for a decade.
Yeah.
And for a reason, James Spader pulls this off as an actor somehow. He has pathos to his character, and he's the slimiest, grossest.
He deserves to be
voyeur. Right?
Yeah.
But you root, in a way, you root for those two characters. How? I don't know. I mean,
it's the magic of Soderbergh. Oh, how about that? Look at that. Fuck Harry Met Sally.
Speaking of creeps.
Yeah. So we'll finish up here. The main reason we have to retape this episode.
Well, other than audio problems.
Right, yes.
We have gotten much better in that regard.
And only that regard.
If you do listen to our other podcasts, our earlier podcasts, we apologize. They were
tough to listen to. Crimes and Misdemeanors. Woody Allen. Final nominee in this subject. Go ahead, Mike.
Woody Allen biofilmography. He was born in 1935 as Allen Stewart Conisberg in Mobile, Alabama. I'm sorry, just kidding. He was born in Brooklyn, New York. But he starts off his life and his career with a lie, because his name is not Woody Allen. His name is Allen Stewart Conisberg.
Yes, the most consequential lie I'm sure he'll ever tell.
Right. Ugh. Allen goes to a lot of summer camps as a kid, and he describes the fact that he was beaten savagely by children of all races and creeds. So that was funny, and funny for us in many ways, until you think about all the reasons he's pariah number one, not pariah number two. Maybe Weinstein's number one. Yeah. All right. Graduated Midwood High School in 1953. Woody Allen was supposedly a darn good baseball player, though he didn't have his baseball career going for him enough that he wasn't also a super talented nerd, because he was apparently someone who would do magic and card tricks every chance he got. So if that wasn't cool in the 1950s.
As all baseball players do growing up.
Right. So I think the baseball thing is kind of overstated. At an early age of 17, he started writing jokes and gags for newspaper columnists, kind of a ghostwriter for them in his neighborhood. Before long, he was making more money than both of his parents combined doing this. He goes to a year of NYU, studies filmmaking, studies under renowned screenwriting guru LeGros Agree, who's got a pretty good book on screenwriting, by the way. But he drops out of NYU, basically to go write jokes and be a comedian and to go do it. So it's a very interesting career path. He doesn't continue studying it. He just goes off and does it. He legally changes his name to Haywood Allen, and they basically
So it's still not Woody?
They give him the nickname Woody for Haywood. So by 19...
He changed his name and is still not known by his name?
Well, he's known... The nickname he gets from his name change is what he
named himself. Well, he could have just been Woody as a regular.
True. Again, lies. Lies at the heart of this. By 19, Woody Allen's joke writing moves into TV sales, where he was accepted into NBC's Writer Development Program in 1955. He quickly landed writing jobs for The Ed Sullivan Show and The Tonight Show soon after. In 1962 alone, Woody Allen was estimated to write at least 20,000 jokes for comedians around New York City. So he's just on a writing binge. Cocaine was probably involved. Apparently, he had a 15-hour-a-day writing habit. So the guy was a machine. Again, his prolific career seems to affirm this.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I mean, we get this. I mean, he makes a movie a year for a reason, because he got his reps as a young person. He's a young career man.
55, too. Jeez.
1960, he began to perform stand-up comedy and eventually honed his neurotic, nebbish, intellectual persona that people would come to know and love, or love to hate.
I know nebbish is how I always describe him to my friends.
By 1965, he nabbed his own TV show, The Woody Allen Show. He also wrote two successful plays in the 60s, one that he would later adapt into a movie called Play It Again, Sam, which is a parody of Casablanca. And it became a pretty darn good movie. 1965
said like a true Northeastern, Casablanca.
Yeah. 1965 was also a big year for Allen, because he made his debut on the silver screen, What's Up, Tiger Lily, his debut film. He would make, like Spike Lee, he would just go on making films from here all the way till now. Essentially, 2 to 3 movies a year would eventually become one movie a year. He is as prolific a screenwriter, director, filmmaker as we have. He's been married twice. I'm sorry, he married twice for 4 years apiece before his romance with Diane Keaton, which lasted for 2 years. He reportedly had a relationship with 17-year-old Manhattan actress Stacey Nelken. Red flag there. Though it was only supposedly a rumor that at least he said that.
Mm-hmm.
His partnership with Mia Farrow lasted 12 years, from 1980 to 1992, which famously broke up.
Ugh.
After Farrow realized that Woody had an affair with her adopted stepdaughter, Soon Yi. So Woody Allen marries Soon Yi and is still with her to this day. There is a much publicized accusation of molestation from Dylan Farrow, who is Mia Farrow's actual daughter. And Dylan Farrow, her story was thrown out by the quote-unquote judge at the time, and Woody was exonerated because of the fact that this was never brought to trial. There was never enough evidence to bring this to trial, I guess. Now, Mia Farrow has stuck to her accusations over all these years. Not Mia Farrow, Dylan Farrow,
right,
excuse me.
Right.
To the point where Time's Up has come out in in support of Dylan Farrow. Stories have reemerged. To our credit, not that we should pat ourselves on the back here, but to our credit, when we originally recorded this, we were like, the biggest point of evidence against Woody Allen molesting his stepdaughter was the fact that he marries his stepdaughter a couple years later. And he was in Sunyi's life when she was like 10 or something.
Yeah.
And then years later, when she's 17, there's naked pictures found, which is the documented reason why Mia Farrow breaks up with Woody Allen.
This part's not fucking disgusting.
This is a man with a gross social life and a probably a predatorial one, like Roman Polanski, like Harvey Weinstein. However, his career has been prolific, has been celebrated. We're going to get into the ins and outs of how his career and his personal life might mesh. But what do you to talk about his filmmaking life? Broadway Danny Rose and Zelig are 100%ers on Rotten Tomatoes. 4 Oscars. He's won Oscars for Hannah and Her Sisters, Midnight in Paris as a screenwriter. He won Best Screenplay, Director, and Annie Hall won Best Picture. I mean, listen, he's made a lot of undeniably good movies.
Yeah, okay, he's talented. Sure. I mean, there's no denying
every
that.
Single critic, for years, he was beloved. At least he was a critical darling.
You're not wrong.
Bananas, Played Against Sam, Sleeper, Mighty Aphrodite, Melinda and Melinda, Match Point, Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Midnight in Paris, Blue Jasmine, Irrational Man. In a huge set of stories over the past year, all these actors and actresses have denounced Woody Allen. They have made a big deal of denouncing him from...
And big names.
Big names, from Laura Dern to Cate Blanchett to Timothée Chalamet. I've never seen this before. This is unprecedented territory.
This is unprecedented territory for sure, because like we keep saying, and we repeated ad nauseum on this is a long time coming for this type of movement, and it's taken too long to get here. But now that we are here, we're seeing these radical sea changes in what's been going on in Hollywood and working with these names and these awful stories that were just, you know, backhand rumors for all these years being discovered as truth. And it's totally changed the dynamic of ways people listen to victims. Thankfully, it's totally changed the way that these men are viewed and allowed to have these professions and careers. Thankfully, it's a new world. And he was never more at the height of his powers than in this Crimes and Misdemeanors way in the 89-90. It's a couple years before the him and Farrow have their falling out, before the Sunyi stuff comes to the tabloids. I mean, he's Woody Allen, prolific filmmaker right here. And that's not the case anymore.
It's not the first time. I mean, we shouldn't make it out like it's something so new, even though this story is somewhat unprecedented. At least the backlash was long overdue. It finally happened. But Charlie Chaplin was getting with 13 to 17-year-olds in his life. So I mean, men with power have been abusing their power for years. However, and it's weird for us as film critics because this man has made good movies.
For me, it's impossible.
Really awkward because he's made funny movies.
For me, it's impossible to you know, leave what he did aside. And I think
Hollywood is wrestling with this fact right now, because here's one of the pillars of at least the New York filmmaking community.
Certainly.
They made documentaries on his life and on his career. That are tributes to him, not one, but more than one documentary that I haven't seen, but I've really stayed away from lately, especially since we've started this podcast.
It's this type of stuff that makes the When Harry Met Sally arguments and that type of stuff so fun for us, because these types of serious, awful stories have just seeped their way into the Hollywood lexicon.
Here's the thing, though. There's a lot of clues left about this man's persona in his films. He has made double-digit movies about characters who get away with murder. Literally. Crimes and Misdemeanors is one of those movies.
You're not wrong.
Irrational Man. I mean, this guy makes movies about morally bankrupt human beings.
Mm-hmm. You're not wrong. It's a good point.
He's a comedian. Are these admissions of guilt? We can actually analyze Woody Allen's career from another perspective now. And I think we want to do that with Crimes and Misdemeanors and all of his other films. So interesting.
Yeah, we'll do some specs of Crimes and Misdemeanors, released October 13th, 1989, directed and written by Woody Allen, obviously. Three Oscar nominations for this movie, including supporting actor for Martin Landau, best director Woody Allen, and obviously best original screenplay. It's a 104-minute runtime, produced by Jack Rollins and Charles H. Jaffe Productions and distributed by Orion Pictures. $19 million budget in a box office that failed to make back its budget, brought in only $18.25 million for its box office run. Critically beloved, though, 8.0 IMDb rating on 48,000 reviews, 93% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating on 43 critic reviews, 40 of them being positive. The average score is an 8 out of 10 for the critics, 91% audience score on 23,000 reviews on Rotten Tomato. Average audience score is 4 out of 5 and a 77 meta rating from Metacritic as well. Crimes and Misdemeanors is another one, another movie that's kind of explained by its title. You have these two dueling storylines, one involving Martin Landau trying to escape the attempted blackmail of his longtime mistress, and
this scummiest story. He's a judge. He's somebody who the public is deifying, who's giving banquets in his honor.
Big time. That's how we start. Yeah. And he's
clue, perhaps.
His mistress, played wonderfully, Dolores Pally, played by Angelica Houston, who I thought was magnificent in this.
Yes.
Boy, was she off.
And so was Martin Landau, for that matter.
Yep. Yeah, well, well-deserved nomination, sure. Yeah. And then there's the dueling storyline of Cliff Stern, Woody Allen's character, who is a struggling filmmaker, a documentarian, who...
Whose last had sex on Hitler's birthday.
Which I laughed
which
at.
Which is funny.
I laughed
which is
at
funny.
So hard.
God damn it.
I knew the date because it was Hitler's birthday.
Yeah.
Now we've both done the Woody Allen impression.
Oh, no.
He is commissioned basically to make a documentary about his brother-in-law, who is this big-time filmmaker.
Alan Alda.
Lester, played by Alan Alda. Alan Alda is kind of the holier-than-thou, I'm a success in life, everybody else is failure, he's got his nose up in the air, and Woody Allen is both jealous of, envious of, and angry with him. So Woody Allen makes it his duty to make a farce documentary about him.
Intercutting footage of Mussolini,
yeah,
into that, and good God, is that scene funny?
The
when
payoff is
Woody
so
Allen
worth it.
Watches the documentary with Alan Alda.
He finally
Alda
has
he gets
a
fired.
Screening of the documentary that he plays for Alan
hard.
Alda in private, and it's just this, like Mike said, it's Mussolini, it's Alan Alda flipping his shit and yelling, being portrayed in this poor light. Right. There's a jacket, an actual donkey on screen with his back to the camera. You're saying Alan Lester's saying, which is if it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny.
Which is his go-to line.
Part
yeah,
is Woody Allen throughout the whole thing
dying
just
laughing.
Loving every minute of this in his seat, eating like
literally bouncing
yeah.
bouncing
oh,
up and down
so
laughing
funny.
So hard, which is it's just very
and
very
that's
funny.
What pisses me off about the whole thing,
because it's hysterical.
He's so talented, this is legitimately funny stuff, but yeah, he's a creep. So we have him getting fired by Lester. Meanwhile, the Martin Landau character hires, after dealing with one of his friends In the dentist's office, basically, we have a Law and Order reunion. Sam Waterston and Jerry Orbach play intricate roles in this. Jerry Orbach basically plays a hitman for hire, who Martin Landau finally has been pressured into talking to, because Angelica Houston is saying, I'm going to expose you for embezzling money. So this guy is not only an adulterer, but he's embezzling funds. I'm going to expose you for embezzling unless you let me talk to your wife, because Martin Landau has, as every good, you know, cheater has done, promised his mistress that he was going to leave his wife. So he has her dealt with, has her killed. He sees the body for himself. And the last part where we left off, the Cliff character, was he's also having feelings for this production assistant, Mia Farrow.
Yeah, Woody Allen and Mia Farrow.
Hallie's is her character's name, where he wants her basically because Lester attempted to get her and she turned him down at first.
And this is one of the first dueling plot lines where Woody has done the serious drama and the funny comedy, the shtick-filled comedy, bringing those two plot lines to a head in the final act. This is perhaps his most recognizable version of this. He's done it again in Melinda, Melinda, even though that was a more comic, farcical look at this type of structure. But it's very innovative in how he's meshed these two together, and you know why it's being recognized as in his screenwriting circles for sure.
Yeah, he finally falls for Farrow's character hard. He asks her to marry her. We cut to 4 months later, some big banquet where Judah and Lester and Cliff and Hallie, all our characters are under the same roof for the first time all movie. We find out that Hallie has in fact agreed to marry Lester, not Cliff. So the big successful producer keeps getting more successful. Woody Allen is crestfallen and begrudged and ends up sitting on a bench. Judah sits next to him and tells him basically his life story about what happened.
So Martin Landau's character, this is fascinating, tells Woody Allen's character,
yes,
the story of the murder of his mistress. Woody Allen's character, who has committed all the misdemeanors, right? The other characters committed the crimes.
Yeah, that's what happened.
He takes this story in stride, like, this guy's bullshitting me, or like this, you know, and actually gives him moral feedback on it.
Yeah, he basically says that it's almost too unbelievable for a Hollywood movie. And Judah's response is, I'm talking about reality. If you want a happy ending, go see a Hollywood movie. And that's how we fade out. Crimes and Misdemeanors. That's the movie. That's the Woody Allen piece.
Innovative script for sure. It has its moments in terms of its comedy. I think the drama works too. And it's fascinating how... I mean, listen, this is undeniably well written.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's two well thought out, very distinct storylines converging, and like you said, in the third act, at the final.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's going to say Chinatown is a bad movie because Roman Polanski's involved.
Right.
In it. Nobody's going to say Crimes and Misdemeanors is a bad movie because Woody. Well, I mean, you could say it, but you'd be wrong. Unfortunately,
it's a well written script. Yeah, it's funny. It's funny.
Is there an insidious nature underneath this? Again, it's a man getting away with murder. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. It's hearing his stuff, and I know
I feel like I got to take a shower.
I know. I've heard it over and over again. It's stuff that's been like bashed into me because it's so of the moment now with these movements, and it's just every time you hear it, it never gets easier to hear.
Like, Dead Poets Society is kind of morally bankrupt. We agreed on that. But this is like...
It's not done by a morally bankrupt person.
A morally bankrupt person who we know for a fact is morally bankrupt. Well, maybe,
but that's what makes,
allegedly
that's
morally
what I said. That's what makes reviewing Dead Poets Society, reviewing When Harry Met Sally, fun. We're poking fun at art, but it's art. It's still... It's just an expression.
But this
it's not the guy.
Takes the fun and makes it serious.
It's real and it's gross. And it makes me, like, I can't, I try to be as unbiased as I
Here's
can.
Here's the thing. Ironically, this movie is the funniest of those three.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, Ugh is right.
WTF. Yeah. I mean.
Let's talk about best scene, worst scene as best we can. What was your favorite?
I have two favorite scenes. One with the Woody Allen plot line, the other with the Martin Landau one. Woody Allen showing his brother-in-law the film he's cut about the brother-in-law's jackass.
Hilarious. Life. My favorite scene by far.
And then, of course, my favorite scene with the Martin Landau plot line was actually a very artsy flashback scene where Martin Landau is taken back in a very Scrooge way to his family dinner table growing up.
That's my least favorite scene.
I thought this was interesting in the fact that the aunt argues his point of view all those years before.
Yeah, but don't you feel it's such a separation from what the tone and the plot of the movie had been up to that point? I mean, we've been so grounded in reality with these real crimes and real misdemeanors.
Well, it makes sense because the man's life is flashing before his eyes after the trauma of what he's just done. I mean, I get the point of it.
I just think it was so clunky, so on the nose, and such a separation.
It's an in-your-face device, and there's no question, but I thought the argument
like
that they're having...
You feel it was too much of a deviation, huh?
Well, I just... They do it in a very... well-written way because
we have to have our civil conflict
serious,
now as opposed to before when we were yelling at
but
each
it's
other.
Serious text subtext. I mean, it's not like it's on the nose writing. I mean, it's well written, it's well done. I think it would be hokey and if it was done wrong.
That's
I'm not gonna begrudge you in the fact that it is an overt device.
Right Fair.
Well, how about you? Best scenes?
You hit them. You hit my best and worst. Man, when Woody Allen is reacting, all his body reactions throughout this movie are hysterical. And it
talent.
It makes me laugh and cringe all at the same time. His body reaction during the documentary,
right?
Hysterical.
But is it scary that Woody Allen is such a good actor?
Yes. That's what I mean. It's terrifying.
That's how we look at it in another way right now.
And that's what makes me cringe about it. Oh, God. But his body, when Lester's talking about all he's accomplished and Woody Allen's at the dinner table, like, mimicking with his face and throwing his hands up, it's all hysterical stuff. But you're absolutely right. It's like, God damn. Stop it.
My worst scene is just because it's so slimy when Martin Landau goes back to Houston's apartment after she's been murdered. It's a necessary scene because you need to see the ramifications of what he's done. It's very necessary, but it's so gross. I mean, it's not a bad scene.
I'd like
it's
to,
again, we it's a movie without a worse scene, really.
You could argue that for
God
sure.
God damn it.
I especially like that scene, though. I like the touch of her staring right at him as he entered. You know, look almost as if she's staring at him for real life, but she's deceased.
It's gross, though.
Yeah, it is. It is. I don't know. It's tough for me to recommend anyone watch a Woody Allen movie at this point. I don't know that I can.
But this movie's in your face.
It does
saying
have its
a man gets away with murder, and this person who has a comic worldview is being told this story at the end of the movie. And then basically they go, okay, what are your thoughts?
Well, no, I didn't even think of what are your
this
thoughts.
This is not a Hollywood
basically,
movie.
Basically him but saying, that's not true. It's not true. You couldn't do that.
You could. Right. While he's about to marry his stepdaughter.
Yeah.
God. In 1989, real life.
Fucking
fiction.
Woody Allen. God damn it.
What the fuck?
Be clean so I can enjoy this and enjoy reviewing it. Those are our five nominees. We're going to perfection now, as we always do at the end of every retrospective. It's been a while. You've heard us hint at it through other episodes in the offseason, but Perfecting Perfection has started. It began in these Oscars retrospective movies. What we do is we take the five nominees that have been given to us in those given years, and we re-rank them in the proper order as we see fit, because we are arrogant douches. So let's start with number five. I'll lead off. No surprise here. When Harry Met Sally, I hate you, I hate everyone, fuck this movie.
Dead Poets Society is my number five.
Yeah, you really don't like that movie, huh?
It's, again, this is where, and this is not the hill I should die on, but Dead Poets Society is it's just morally abhorrent to me. And it's amazing that the rapist who wrote the other movie is not as, that script
I'm
is actually
you.
Saying
I
better
can't.
Things
yeah, I can't.
Than the Dead Poets Society script. I just have a moral objection to Dead Poets Society.
Yeah, can't argue with you, man. Can't argue with you. What's your number four?
My number four is Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
I'm with you. That's my number four as well. Interesting premise.
But here's the thing. Like, Dead Poets Society is well written. Sex, it is. I mean, screenwriting formulas, execution. It happens. And I actually, so none of these are poorly written movies, even though we've kind of been grossed out by
last episode, things you gave
that
Thomas Shulman
in the movie.
You gave Thomas Shulman Red on the Riot Act, but you gave him his due credit.
I try to. Yeah. And that's where I'm trying to backtrack a little bit. I mean, hitting the screenwriting formulas, these movies do it. So even though Sex, Lies, and Videotape is something that's my number four on the list, and our number four on the list, we gave it its props.
Well, they are Oscar nominated films. And I, you know, obviously that doesn't speak the whole story, because there's plenty of times that we've reviewed where films got nominated that just shouldn't have been nominated. But this, I don't think, is one of those times. All these are very well written movies.
Again, we're honest critics, right? Because my number three, Crimes and Misdemeanors, it's by a guy who potentially raped his stepdaughters.
God damn it.
Molested his stepdaughters. And yet we're fucking honest, because he made a good movie. Can scumbags make good movies? The answer is yes.
Never gets easier to hear. Yeah, no,
and they tell good stories.
My number three as well. I also could do without Woody casting Woody as Woody and being the one that gets the girl for a majority of the movie.
But here's the thing. Like, their storytelling prowess kind of works in their criminal life. If they indeed had a criminal life.
It's just all disgusting.
Right? Because they told stories about their lies, their their elaborate web of lies. So,
it's just awful. Yeah, it's my number three as well. Talk about happier times. My number two is Dead Poets Society, which means my number one is Do the Right Thing. I imagine we have the same number one.
We have the same number one. I liked When Harry Met Sally much more than you did.
You're an idiot.
I will hold the torch
for
that
opinion
movie.
Cannot be trusted.
I was playing defense during that entire review.
You were. You held up well, by the way.
I tried.
I was awfully loud and
Olive
awful.
Branch reached out to you. We tried, because a lot of people like that movie. Mike hates it with the passion of a thousand suns.
Terrible movie.
I am one of the few people who hates Dead Poets Society with the passion of a thousand suns, even though you hate certain things.
Your disdain for that movie is much more understandable than mine for Harry Met Sally, I think. I think you share the view with Dead Poets Society with more people.
But I can understand why you hate what you. The fact that we have re-recorded this podcast, now I now understand why you hate When Harry Met Sally. I just think those are not crimes; those are
misdemeanors.
Oh my God, we're such dorks.
We need to stop.
All right,
out.
Do the Right Thing is a great movie, universally yeah. beloved. It is a crime that Do the Right Thing did not win this category.
Is it a misdemeanor though? This is one of the things that we love doing and why we do these retrospectives because, and it's also why we carry the torch for Get Out so hard because
yeah.
in 20 to 30 years, when you look back at some of these things, they were on the wrong side of history. Dead Poets Society is not a more lasting, impactful script than Do the Right Thing. And it's not close, by the way. I mean, Do the Right Thing should have won this category 11 times out of 10. And it probably should have won it of the moment, too. I mean, I know in 1989 I was 2 years old, personally, so I can't speak to personal experience. But
it's so obvious.
Yeah,
that
it's just it's just a glaring oversight and why we love doing it. We do a Perfecting Perfection for the Year in review as well. We sometimes will re-rank the top five of actual the year in total and what should have been nominated. Mike's going to go through some of that right now. What do we have?
And it's just, can I just say this, though? It is disgusting to me how the encapsulation or the derivation of white privilege, the whitest privilege, won over Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, isn't it gross?
It's a sign of the times. With the date rape, by the way. That was okay. It's a sign of the times.
Where a poster boy for the rape is not also nominated in the category.
Yeah. Anyway.
Irony is gives and it takes away. All right. Movies I've seen from 1989. And I mentioned all the big movies from 1989 that are at least notable. All right. The Abyss, All Dogs Go to Heaven.
Great movie.
Babar the Movie. These are movies that I've seen.
You've
and movies
seen
that
Babar
are notable.
The Movie?
When I was a kid. I was five.
I don't even think I knew Babar had a movie.
All right. Back to the Future Part 2. Batman, the Michael Keaton one. Tim Burton. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Which just got announced. They're having a part 3.
I've not seen The Big Picture, but that was a big deal that year. Born on the 4th of July, which I have an unadulterated hatred for.
Oh, wow. All right.
Unfortunately. It says good things. I hate the way Oliver Stone says a lot of things, but there it is. The Burbs with Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Casualties of War. Crimes and Misdemeanors, like mm-hmm. we said. Dead Calm. Dead Poets Society. Do the Right Thing. Driving Miss Daisy.
Which one?
Wins
Best
Picture. Picture yeah. in the year of Do the Right Thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Shame.
Talk about being on the wrong side
fucking
of history.
Fucking shame.
Yep.
Drugstore Cowboy, The Fabulous Baker Boys, Field of Dreams, Ghostbusters 2, Glory, Heathers, Henry V, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, The Karate Kid Part 3, Lean on Me, License to Kill, Bond film, The Little Mermaid, Little Monsters, Look Who's Talking, Major League, Music Box, a well-done drama that year. My Left Foot
Ooh.
Is in this year.
Lewis winning it.
Yeah. Again, kids' movies interspliced with Oscar-nominated movies. Milo and Otis. A movie about
classic.
The reason why I got a pug. Christmas Vacation.
Oh, I watch that movie every year.
Still fucking
have
funny.
To.
The Package with Gene Hackman. Parenthood with Steve Martin. Stephen King's Pet Sematary. Very scary movie.
That's one I've not seen.
Holds
I have to
up
see that.
As a scary movie.
I think they're remaking it, too.
Roadhouse.
Just the name.
Roger and Me, the start of, goddamn.
What a great documentary. Michael Moore.
Say Anything. With the Coons.
John Cusack, yeah.
Sea of Love, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Tango and Cash, Turner and Hooch, a lot of ampersands. Uncle Buck, one of my
That might be your
favorites.
Favorite movie ever.
UHF, another childhood favorite.
Yeah, Big Weird Al, yeah, there you go.
Ours, The War of the Roses, When Harry Met Sally, Lethal Weapon 2, Cinema, Paradiso, and Kickboxer. Those were the...
A lot of big movies you named, too. I didn't realize it was such a massive year for a lot of hallmarks. Getting in under the wire of the 90s.
So, can I count down from 14 down to 1?
You can do whatever you want, man. You own half this
pod. My number 14 was UHF. I like the Weird Al movie.
Fair.
It has its moments. My number 13 was Pet Sematary. It's got some major flaws, but there are some scares, man.
I might watch that after you leave today.
In that movie. Number 12, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. It works as a comedy.
Do you know that was supposed to be a drama?
It might have worked better as a drama in a horror movie, no? Maybe Thomas Shulman mucked it up again.
Reference that in part 1 of this series. If you didn't listen to it, go back and check it out.
My 11 was Say Anything. Talk about stalking being allowed.
Yeah, but it was standing it was outside. Cusack. He meant well.
Standing outside her door.
Parodied in Deadpool 2, by the way.
Yeah. Back to the Future Part 2. Very good movie. Mm-hmm. Major League.
Oh, hilarious.
Funny. You want me to go down there and beat the shit out of him? Crimes and Misdemeanors. Begrudgingly, it's a good movie. About it, huh? Number 8. Number 7, Christmas Vacation for me. Number 6, even though Driving Miss Daisy, it's shameful that it won over Do the Right Thing, is a well-done movie, in my
That's
opinion.
That's fine. It leaves a bad taste in my mouth because of what it accomplished.
Number 5, we're going to both give our number 5s now.
All right, so let's perfect perfection for the total year in review. Number 5, Michael.
The Little Mermaid. Under the Sea.
I can't even make fun of you.
It's a great movie, man.
It's in my top 5. It's my number 2.
Wow. Perhaps one of the few movies I actually saw in 1989 that I remember seeing with my grandpa in the theaters, along with Honey, I Shrunk the Kids with my dad, I think. Dad and my
brothers. We're only a couple years removed from the first. I mean, Disney did get the first animated picture to be nominated for Best Picture, Beauty and the Beast.
Our friend, our mutual friend, my brother, John, was so small, and he was 2 years old. He was so small, my grandfather, and he always told this story, so I'm not misremembering this, would have to hold down the seat at the movie theaters because it would collapse on John.
That's weird, because I thought little John was born as a meatball, an actual made of pork and
he turned into
beef.
A meatball, but this was before his meatball physique.
Interesting. Like an actual Italian, you see
he was top heavy. He wasn't bottom heavy back then.
My number 5, I always, in these re-rankings, I try to give love to a movie that I know would never be nominated, but I personally enjoy and find a lot of humor in or love for in my number 5 category and position. That's Christmas Vacation for me. I fucking love that movie. Would never be nominated in any world. That movie might be the perfect holiday movie.
Don't touch! That movie's funny as hell
I laugh every year watching it. God. On the same beats. My number 4 is Field of Dreams because I'm a baseball player by heart and a sucker for those. I think it's Kevin Costner's best sports movie by far. If you build it, they will come.
It's utter nonsense.
Yeah.
However, it works somehow. It does work.
Fucking nothing but father and son together like baseball.
Play catch, yeah.
What's your number 4?
When Harry Met Sally.
You son of a bitch.
So we both have movies the other guy hates at number 4. Yeah, because I'll be honest. I don't like Field of Dreams. I don't.
Wow,
I just don't.
That's surprising.
I don't.
You being a coach.
I also stopped playing baseball.
Yeah, that could be.
I had problems with that sport.
Number 3.
I don't like to fail 7 out of 10 times to be good, but I failed 8 out of 10 times. So
I'm used to failing 7 out of 10 times. That's why it's just
I was better at baseball. I might be better at life, I think. Damn it.
I don't know how that parallel works, but all right. What's your number 3?
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I thought it's real. I love the Indiana Jones.
Can I tell you
Indiana
something
Jones
that's
trilogy.
Very, very embarrassing?
Yeah.
I've never seen the Indiana Jones.
Oh, you like it. It's a treat.
Nor the Back to the Future trilogies.
You've never seen either of
no.
them? Dude, you should.
I know. I have to.
You
I will.
Should.
I have to.
All right,
I'm
we
a bad
do a
person.
Retrospective
I'm not
just
a good movie
too.
Critic.
Come on. You got to see
cats
those.
Cats out of the bag there, yeah.
Spielberg.
I've been too busy watching Legion.
Ugh.
Or the spirit.
Now I'm angry. Now I'm angry. You were. I was feeling like charitable.
Would you like to know
you.
What happened in Halloween 4 and 5?
Oh, you've seen the wrong. Some of this. Listen, I've seen the wrong movies too. But in this regard, you've seen the wrong movies.
I own the producer's cut, the unreleased theatrical version.
Our
of Halloween
audience
6.
Agrees with us. Yeah, those of them who.
I know. I'm a bad person. I need to see those. I promise you, I will see those. I'm sorry.
My number 2 is Uncle Buck, moving on.
I didn't say my number 3. My number 3 is Batman. Because that Joker portrayal by Jack Nicholson was the most famous bad
guy
portrayal.
That movie is unfucking watchable if you rewatch it, by the way.
It's more watchable than Batman Returns holds up.
When was the most... I'm just curious now. When have you recently... Because it was on Netflix for a while.
Yeah.
When have you rewatched Batman?
As of probably the last 12 months.
I couldn't get through it.
Really?
I tried.
I think it still holds up in a lot of ways. Obviously, it's tough. But all
we
the movies
different
from the 80s
in movies
are tough. But that portrayal of Joker.
We have different
Joker,
tolerance levels in the movies.
Portrayal of Joker is timeless. It's timeless.
Yeah, it's
probably
great.
Not the most famous portrayal anymore because of Heath Ledger's, but that's my number 3. My number 2, I said,
you
was...
You are my number 1. A guy.
I already said my number 2 was Little Mermaid. You said Uncle Buck.
Uncle Buck's my number 2.
I
wanted to make it my number 1 because it's like one of my favorite movies of all time. Do the Right Thing is an objectively better movie.
Yes.
But
yes.
In terms of enjoyment levels, Do the Right Thing is infuriating at times. We've realized this. Uncle Buck is a happier film.
And we're talking, again, about the screenplay category, but we're talking movies for the sake
Giant
of these
Giant Pancakes, come yeah. on. John Candy Dance, come on. That's like my go-to dance.
So your favorite movie podcast had both Christmas Vacation and Uncle Buck in their top fives for 1989. That's no big deal.
We had it over Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
The Oscar-winning film.
I'll stand by that, by the way.
Yeah, no. This is why we do an Oscars podcast. Regular schmoes reviewing Oscar
That's
movies.
Right. So let us know your top five for the year of 1989.
Do the Right Thing was our number one.
Without question, Do the Right Thing was our number one, both on the re-rank of the nominees and of the re-rank of the year in total. But let us know if you feel differently about it or about anything we've said in the last two episodes. You can reach out to us, Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, and Oscar on the Twitter machine, MikeMikeAndOscar.com, MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com, Mike and Oscar on Reddit. Go ahead and reach out to us any of those ways. We love hearing from you guys. Anywhere you are on the internet, so you type in Mike and Oscar, you'll see our bright smiling faces. And like I said, let us know your thoughts. We finally got back to these retrospectives. 89 Best Original Screenplay in the books.
I'm proud of us. And this is fun to record. So
really
we hope
is.
It's fun yeah. to listen to. We recognize that spoiler territory is difficult to avoid, even though we try not to ruin the movies,
yeah.
and even though we kind of talk about the plot. So let us know what you think and how we can navigate spoilers going forward. If you didn't like how we did it here, because I'm curious, we haven't really cracked that nut
on how
to figure it out.
Still trying to balance it.
Talk about a best original screenplay without talking about spoilers.
The end
is almost
yes.
impossible, right?
Tough to do, yeah.
So we had to do it. So we're going to go non-spoilers for the acting categories, I think.
Yeah, and we might have a couple of those coming up in terms of retrospectives
on
the
one.
Horizon. So
yes,
be on the lookout for those. Reality sucks, guys. Keep watching movies with us, and we will see you next time.
See ya.